listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, a program developed at UW-Madison is helping preschool kids learn kindness and empathy. We'll find out how the lessons are being incorporated into the new season of Sesame Street.
First, researchers at UW-Madison built a computer simulation tool that allows communities to map their vulnerabilities to extreme rainfall without experiencing the real thing. They've developed this technology in recent years. They call it Extreme Storm Transposition.
They're able to look at a storm that already happened in one place in Wisconsin and model what the damage would look like if it had hit another place. This computer modeling is valuable as climate change makes the upper Midwest more susceptible to frequent and intense rains. Scott Gordon reported on this simulation technology. He's associate editor of WisConText.
Scott, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
We'll talk about this simulation effort. What are these researchers trying to do here?
Well, really the whole point was that climate change and the consequences thereof are kind of an abstraction to a lot of people. And when it comes to flooding projections and concepts like the 100-year flood and 500-year flood and so forth, there's all kinds of debate about those things, and it doesn't necessarily drive things home for people. So the idea was that by taking a storm that had happened and was kind of in recent memory, and where people had really seen the kind of human and environmental fallout of it, and by kind of shifting it somewhere else, they could sort of get people to see that their cities had vulnerabilities to these kinds of storms if they were to happen there.
So the first run on this uses a real-life rainfall situation in Wisconsin in the Dells, Lake Delton area. Can you talk about that flood?
Right. So this was the flood in June of 2008, and there was rain over several days that eventually caused Lake Delton, for example, to wash out into the Wisconsin River. Washed out a section of County Highway out there, and created, of course, all kinds of destruction right around the peak tourism season for people in that area.
And then they took that flood, if I understand this correctly, and said, okay, what if this rainfall happened somewhere else? And they parked it over Dane County for their simulation.
That's right. And again, the whole point here was that storm happened, 50 miles from here, could have easily blown this way. Somehow,
right, with rainfall, something that happened here, with if things had tweaked a little differently in the weather, it could have hit 50, 100 miles away.
Right. And so, again, something that's a little bit more concrete for people to get their heads around than, well, you can expect X level of flooding every 100 years or every 200 years or so forth.
Right. And because it's a 100-year flood doesn't mean it won't happen next year
right.
If things break the wrong way.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how do they take this kind of rainfall? How do they do this? How do they transpose and try to figure out what this kind of rain would do in another place?
Well, essentially they use, federal weather data about what happened in the time frame of that storm in that area. So they're able to kind of determine the sheer amount of rainfall over time and things like that. And the model cannot account for everything. There's kind of a saying among researchers who use models that all models are wrong, but some are useful, I believe, is the the thing that people say about that. The idea is you can kind of get a sense of where Madison or another city, if you applied this kind of modeling somewhere else, would be vulnerable and where some of the biggest impacts would be and what kinds of choices people could make ahead of time to maybe mitigate those impacts and, make them a little less dire.
We'll get into that in a bit. Can you talk about the researchers? Who's behind this effort?
Well, the kind of chief investigators on this were Ken Potter, who's a retired civil engineering professor at UW-Madison, and David Liebel, who is a stormwater expert and engineer, also recently retired, who worked with UW Extension and had, I believe, other appointments kind of within the UW system.
So what did they find when they took the best model they could come up with, parked that 2008 storm over the Madison area? What did it look like in their projection?
Well, what they found was that there would be a lot of very significant, possibly catastrophic flooding in central Madison. You know, if you look at some graphics they generated at the time, you see kind of large swaths of the Isthmus area, which for people not in Madison is kind of the central area of the city between Lake Monona and Lake Mendota. Large areas of it are kind of covered in water, and this would have affected, you know, neighborhoods elsewhere in the city, possibly shut down the airport and things like that, and just, you know, really created havoc, especially in these low-lying areas where, you know, they were built up a long time ago, and the infrastructure is old, and the storm sewers can only do so much to get that water out of there.
Talking to Scott Gordon from WisContext about efforts to project the impact of heavy rainfall, severe weather events in communities around Wisconsin. And I think a key point that comes out of this, Scott, that you wrote about is we think of floods as a natural disaster. I'm doing air quotes there, but it seems like a really big part of the natural disaster is what we've built, how we've built a city, whether it's Madison or any other community around Wisconsin. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So the choices that people make when building new development, building roads, you know, expanding basically the human footprint on the landscape makes, you know, a huge difference in where rainwater ends up when it falls. You know, if you're adding more pavements and more roofs and things, then the water that comes down when it rains is going to have less opportunity to kind of seep back into the ground, you know, and or, you know, replenish the groundwater, and more of it's going to kind of run off on the surface, and that's called runoff, and it's going to end up in lakes and rivers. It's going to end up in storm sewers, and basically, as people kind of develop the landscape, that's just going to put more water kind of running off and more on the surface and interrupt kind of that natural cycle of that rain and groundwater has and those kind of more natural ways that water is controlled.
And is the thinking behind this model, again, putting rainfall, seeing what extreme rainfall would look like in a community, is the goal to have local planners, local politicians look at this and say, oh, we should think about this as we make decisions for the future?
Yeah, exactly. And basically, you know, the point that a lot of folks have made is that to some extent you are stuck with choices that were made a long time ago. You know, you can't necessarily go back into downtown Madison and retrofit all these old storm sewers with something better. At least if you did, it would be, you know, incredibly expensive and arduous. But as you're building new development, you can make better choices about what kinds of storm sewers you put in, what kinds of strategies you employ in building to kind of prevent flooding or at least, you know, mitigate the impact of flooding. And, you know, there's, you know, obviously all kinds of other choices that people can make about, you know, whether it's, you know, adding more green space or building rain gardens or building green roofs or what have you to sort of make that impact a little bit less significant, give that water that's coming down some more places to go that aren't surface water and storm sewers, you know, or ultimately, God forbid, buildings and streets.
And is the plan to use this model and check out other communities around the state? Are they going to keep replicating this modeling experiment?
Well, right now, the model is sort of wrapped up as far as these two researchers are concerned. Of course, it's something that researchers in the future can build on. You know, after they published their findings, they did have a lot of discussions with local and regional officials in the Madison area about, you know, what kinds of things can we do to strengthen, you know, stormwater ordinances and things like that. Again, things that govern new development as it happens and attempt to mitigate some of the impacts that new development has on stormwater runoff.
Discussions were had. I mean, did this model start to impact decisions already, or is it just now part of the conversation?
Well, it's led to a lot of recommendations about what people should do. I'm not 100% certain, actually, how much of it has been translated into policy, but it's something that people are thinking about. You know, one thing that Ken Potter, one of the researchers, told me was that he wanted to get people's attention. You know, and of course, there's this whole abstraction at work here, again, not just with 100-year floods and the like, but also with the fact that climate change is expected to, you know, increase the amount of extreme rainfall that we see. And of course, the relationship between climate change and a given weather event might be very nuanced, but he sort of wanted a way to, again, make that seem a little more concrete. And I think kind of the discussions that came out of that sort of demonstrate how he sees that playing out.
Scott, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much, Rob.
Scott Gordon is associate editor of WisContext. He was telling us there about the UW-Madison computer modeling tool that maps extreme storms on communities to see how they'll hold up. A new season of Sesame Street starts today on Wisconsin Public Television. The 35 episodes revolve around kindness, a theme that started last season. Here's Elmo earlier this year reflecting on his own kindness, talking to a Wall Street Journal reporter.
Elmo helped Zoe learn how to ride a scooter, and she was worried that she wouldn't know how. And Elmo said that if she keeps practicing, she could do it. And you know what? She did.
Right.
She finally did.
And how did it make you feel after your friend Zoe was able to ride that scooter?
Yeah, it made Elmo feel glad that she could do it.
Sesame Workshop consulted with the Center for Healthy Minds at UW-Madison about how to teach kindness on the show. Now the center is giving away its 12-week kindness curriculum to preschool teachers.
Chan McGeehy is the Learning and Development Program Lead at Healthy Minds Innovations. That's a nonprofit organization collaborating on this work with the Center for Healthy Minds at UW-Madison. Chan, welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be here.
So how did this collaboration come about between UW-Madison and Sesame Street?
Yeah, so Sesame Street was investigating kindness and turned to us as we have some experiences training students and teachers in kindness. So as that clip showed, kindness is something that we can actually train, we can get better in. So a couple of our experts, my colleagues, Lisa Thomas-Prince, Lori Gustafson, and Laura Pinger headed out to New York to meet with the crew and shared with them some of the insights that we've garnered from our research.
And what has your research shown about why kindness matters? Because it's, you know, I think of it as, in a way, a soft skill, being nice to other people. Obviously, it's important and it makes everyone's quality of life better. But are there other benefits?
Yeah, it's interesting. So from previous research, we know that kind of emotional intelligence is, in fact, a greater predictor of life outcomes, like financial outcomes, health outcomes, family outcomes, than IQ. And so if we can train in these things to improve our emotional quotient, then we're supporting kids in kind of furthering all sorts of outcomes we'd hope for them.
And academics, part of that.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, part of what happens oftentimes in schools and my backgrounds as a public school teacher is it's easy to kind of get over-focused on the academic side of things and forget that there's these soft skills that kind of create a foundation that allows students to have academic success as well as social success.
So can you tell us a little bit about what actually happened during the collaboration with Sesame Street? Was Elmo there? Did you get to meet Elmo?
I think Elmo was present. I've seen pictures with Big Bird. Uh-huh. And I know they were able to visit the set and kind of like relive some of their childhood dreams.
And when you presented what you learned, what was the Sesame Street shop most interested in?
I think they were most interested in this idea that these things like patience and kindness and generosity are qualities that we can train, that we can get better in, that we can practice. So for example, one of the things that Elmo does in this current season is he has like Elmo's kindness play-by-play. We're going to go back and reflect on a scene where something happened and kind of bring about those qualities of kindness again and really feel it as it was happening in the moment.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the curriculum. I think those of us who are parents or who have strong memories of our early years remember our parents saying things like, don't say anything. If you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. And don't do something that would make you feel bad. And it's been these kind of simple aphorisms, you know, along with maybe a timeout or something. So how do you actually teach kindness?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the kindness curriculum is kind of has two kind of elements to it. It's a mindfulness-based pro-social curriculum. So the mindfulness-based part means it's happening in the present moment. We're aware of emotions, thoughts, sensations as they're happening. And when we're aware of what's happening, then we can choose how to respond. So for example, with 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds, if there's a disagreement, in the curriculum we have what we call peace wands. And so you have a star listener and somebody who's speaking from the heart. And so if one child is speaking from the heart, then their job is just kind of share what's happening for them in an uninterrupted, kind of authentic way. And the star listener is just listening, fully receiving whatever it is that this other child has to say. So rather than say just listen or, you know, be kind, we actually kind of train in what does it look like when you're actually listening with a full heart to somebody else.
So how important is it to teach kindness rooted to the idea of being in the present moment?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think our curriculum takes the approach, since it's a mindfulness-based curriculum, that kind of the only moment we have that we can act in is this moment right now. And so by being aware of the sensations, emotions, thoughts that are happening right now, then maybe we can make wiser choices on how we'd like to interact with somebody. We know what's happening for us internally. And then also by kind of being aware of our own internal world, we become aware of, oh, this is probably true for other people. Other people experience these emotions, these thoughts. So our empathy, our compassion also goes up when we're more in tune with the current moment.
I saw or read a description of kids who are practicing breathing, sort of deep breathing with a little stone on their belly. Mm. How does that help?
Yeah, we call that belly buddies.
is the stone the belly buddy?
That is the buddy. So that's kind of an old saying too, right? People have said for a long time, you know, just kind of take a deep breath, right? You know, kind of to pause.
It's really hard to do that though if you don't know what it feels like.
It's so subtle to pay attention to the breath. So using like the stone on the belly or a stuffed animal on your belly, you can kind of just feel the belly kind of rise up and kind of let the belly fall down. And not only can this be a calm thing, but it starts to turn us toward what's happening in our internal experience. Sometimes we think about mindfulness as part of it is paying attention to what's happening on the outside, and part of it's paying attention to what's happening on the inside. So this belly buddy begins that process for us.
We're talking with Chad McGeehee right now, a learning and development program lead at Healthy Minds Innovations, which collaborates with the Center for Healthy Minds at UW-Madison, talking about the new kindness curriculum being offered by the center and also being picked up by Sesame Street. And Chad, there's some research out there that shows that a lot of parents fundamentally think of the world as an unkind place. Do you think that something like this helps address that problem on some level?
Yeah, I do think it, you know, it absolutely does. What comes to mind is kind of the phrase, you know, think globally and act locally. The world has been and probably will continue to have lots of challenges. So the real question then becomes, how are we working with it? How are we relating to it? And the opportunity we have is right now in this moment with the person that we're with or the family that we're going to be going home to or the neighbors that we have or the colleagues that we're with. What are we doing to engender the sort of relationships and communication here that can have kind of ripple effects that go out, you know, potentially across the globe?
And this curriculum is geared for preschoolers. Why preschool? What's going on then that makes it fertile?
Yeah, it's a great question. So one of the things is we know that this is a time in development where there's a lot of neuroplasticity that's happening, or we know that the brains of children at this age are changing dramatically and really quickly. And so if we can start to incorporate some of these ways of being with our own experience and training to be with our own experience in these ways, then the idea is that these kind of will follow the students throughout their not only academic careers but throughout the lifespan.
So you said the idea is, do we know if it's true? Does it last? Does it stick around and help kids down the road, maybe when they're grown-ups?
And this is one of the open research questions that still needs to be investigated. So we know that some of the impacts will last for children, but we need further studies to investigate this more.
And is there research that it helps the kid who is doing the kind act, not just maybe the child who needs that kindness? I guess that would be Zoe in the Zoe and Elmo scenario with the scooter. Elmo is nice to Zoe, encourages her to ride her bike. Does Elmo get benefits?
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things, especially about the mindfulness-based part, is when a child or any of us acts, you know, kindly or compassionately to somebody else, maybe our intention is to help this person or relieve their suffering or have them, you know, feel better in some sense. But if we're paying attention to our own experience, we realize that acting in these ways is also beneficial for us. We get a certain amount of joy and happiness from supporting and helping others.
Is there anyone who objects to this kind of approach, or at least maybe from another level, taking time out of a school day where it could be spent learning about letters and numbers and some more fundamental things, and instead you're working on something, you know, like a belly buddy or a kindness wand, that kind of thing? Is there pushback at all?
Yeah, even inside of me, I can feel it as a teacher. Something we think about all the time is instructional minutes, right? Mm-hmm. Every minute is precious in the classroom. But one of the things that we're finding, and teachers are consistently reporting this, is by taking the time to do belly buddies or do some of these other practices, that they actually gain time back. Classroom management changes in the classroom where they don't have to spend as much time maybe sorting out some of the challenges and the ramifications of what happens. So for example, students coming back from recess, a lot can happen, or coming back from lunch. And so if there's some practices we do that can help children settle, kind of work with whatever happened, you know, at these other times, then as teachers, we can move back to instruction more quickly.
Now, you said there's a lot of neuroplasticity in the preschool age, which might make this a really fertile time to practice kindness curriculum. But I think about also what we hear about, for instance, cyberbullying and the difficulties in middle school and high school. Is there any evidence, or are you looking at all at later years when it can be even more difficult for kids?
Yeah, we are looking at later years and hope to expand this work kind of across K-12. And part of the work that we're doing is collaborating with all of the school districts whom we are partnering with so that this isn't just kind of a research study that happens in isolation, but can start to inform a culture so that, you know, all children and teachers that are in this environment, including parents, if we start to add parents into the mix and support them in exploring these practices, then we can have even more impact.
And where would you like to see this go maybe 10 years from now? What would this curriculum look like?
Yeah, I think right now what we'd like to do is get this curriculum in the hands of as many teachers, educators, parents, caregivers as possible, and support these people in exploring these practices for themselves and the children in their lives, so that when we start to think about what's important in educating our children alongside with, you know, reading, writing, and math, we're thinking about kindness, patience, you know, and balance.
Chad, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about it.
My pleasure.
We were talking there with Chad McGeehy, the Learning and Development Program Lead at Healthy Minds Innovations, which collaborates with the Center for Healthy Minds at UW-Madison.
And you can catch the debut episode of Sesame Street's 47th season on Wisconsin Public Television, a rebroadcast tomorrow at 11, and then new episodes of Sesame Street air weekdays at 10:30 a.m. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
K is for kindness, a simple word, it's true. But it's amazing what a word can do, amazing what a word can do. When you help someone in need,
that's kindness.
When you plant a little seed,
that's kindness.
When you give a pal a hug,
that's kindness.
Get me hold a ladybug,
that's kindness too. And when you try a little kindness.
Three Republican state senators struck a deal with Governor Scott Walker on Friday to pass the full state budget in the Senate. The budget was originally due on July 1st, but many issues held up the bill for the past 11 weeks. It now heads to the governor's desk.
Molly Beck is a state capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Molly, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Molly, let's start with the three Republican state senators who were kind of negotiating to the bitter end there. Who were they?
So the senators that were more reluctant than their colleagues were Senators Chris Kapinga, Steve Nass, and Dewey Strobel. A fourth senator, David Craig, also did not want to vote for the bill and ultimately didn't. But the three that kind of struck a deal with the governor were Kapinga, Nass, and Strobel.
And what kind of issues were the four and then the three of them raising with the budget?
So they had a number of issues that some were related to they wanted to expand the private school voucher program. Other concerns they had to do with oversight on the Department of Transportation and making some changes there. Part of the, I guess, the deal that they struck with the governor was to move up the repeal of the prevailing wage for state construction projects to take effect immediately rather than have a delay when that happens. The governor also said he would agree to veto changes that were included in the budget that would have removed local oversight of rock quarries used for public works or private construction projects. He also agreed to eliminate a multi-million-dollar study into interstate tolling for the state as well.
So no toll road study. these lawmakers in the Senate, they'd wanted to renegotiate this within the legislature. This is at a time, though, when the Assembly had already passed their version of the budget, so they would have had to come back to work, in effect. How did lawmakers in the Assembly, especially Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, react to the holdouts in their fellow Republican holdouts in the Senate?
Right. The Republicans in the Assembly, these two houses have been feuding all summer, but at the end there, he you know, he disagreed with that approach to getting the budget worked out and resolved finally. He said that their list of requests for the governor amounted to a ransom list, and said things like they were holding the state hostage. He also said when the assembly took up the budget bill that they, you know, he made it pretty clear that he did not want to come back and vote on the bill again.
Ultimately, they made this deal with Governor Walker to veto some of the things they were worried about. So why was this the resolution ultimately?
I think, you know, the budget has been, you know, it's been late. It's been almost 3 months late at this point. I think everybody really wanted to see it get wrapped up. And while we haven't seen the full list of vetoes that the governor has agreed to make, his veto message hasn't been released yet. He did say that he was willing to do these changes, and he announced the changes that I talked about before because he agreed with them. He didn't have any issue with them. So I think they got to a point where they could agree, and they all wanted to get it done.
Talking to Molly Beck from the Wisconsin State Journal, looking at the long budget process. Apparently, light at the end of the tunnel now. It has passed both houses of the legislature, now waiting for Governor Walker and his veto pen. I want to give a listen to one of the holdouts we've been talking about in the Senate, Delafield Republican Senator Chris Kapinga. Here's a listen to what he said about this, what looks like resolution.
I don't think anybody is extremely happy. Nobody loves this budget from the three who are going to vote yes. But again, it got us close enough to where we want to get this done, get the state moving again.
Not exactly a high five and a victory lap, at least from these Senate holdouts.
Right. And Senator David Craig, who did ultimately vote no on the budget, his big issue with the budget was the spending levels. There's a lot of new spending for schools, for example, in this budget, and his complaint with it is that it needed to, you know, that the spending levels needed to be reduced significantly.
Now, there were Republican majorities in both chambers of the legislature, but there were Democrats there, too, at this Senate vote. Did they vote as a block against the budget?
Yes. The Democrats all voted against the budget, and there were five Republican members of the Assembly that also voted against the budget. And those members were kind of from similar places as the senator and senators who initially opposed and the one that did vote against the budget. And they're from the very conservative counties around Milwaukee.
So you had some Republicans voting with Democrats against the budget for basically opposite reasons.
Right, yes.
And so what were Democrats saying about the budget? What was their messaging?
Their message, they use the word rigged a lot. That was their message, that they felt that this budget was giving more to people that didn't need it and didn't give enough to people that didn't. There were a couple tax proposals that the governor made in his initial budget proposal that would have helped out poor families, and the budget committee got rid of those in favor of some tax proposals that benefit wealthier individuals in Wisconsin. So that was their message. They kind of honed in on that there was, while there were, you know, there was a lot more money for schools, which is something that they've asked for years. They said that didn't make up for the cuts that had been passed in previous budgets, and also these other changes that they felt weren't fair.
Now, the budget is the better part of, you know, what the state government does. Almost everything gets covered in that. And this is the last budget before a big midterm election a little over a year from now. What's Republican messaging as far as, you know, this being a document that they're ready to run on next year?
Right. I think when the governor first proposed this budget, he was really focusing on the amount, the school funding level that he was proposing in the budget. There's been a lot of polling in recent years that there's a lot of public support for adding dollars for public schools, and I think that proposal will be something that you might see on the campaign trail as he, you know, gears up for another reelection bid, especially with his opponent, who is the state superintendent, Department of Public Instruction. I think that will be prevailing message in the campaign trail.
One of many potential opponents, of course. But yeah, right. The most prominent at the statewide level for now. For
right,
sure.
Right.
We're talking about the state budget, which just passed in the state legislature last week after an 11-week delay. Molly Beck with us now from the Wisconsin State Journal.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the state budget that passed? What do you think of the priorities reflected in that budget? And what about the tax dollars? Where do you want them to go? What did you make of this 11-week delay? Did it bother you or not so much? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe get to your calls in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our conversation now about the state budget with Molly Beck from the Wisconsin State Journal.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the budget as it stands now, passed by both houses of the legislature, waiting for Governor Walker's vetoes and his signature ultimately? What do you think of the priorities in that budget? Are you happy the Foxconn incentive deal passed? News on that today, too. Call in at 800-642-1234 or post your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Alice on the line in Sheboygan. Alice, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I am not happy with the budget. Very unhappy because of the lack of guarding our waters in Wisconsin. Particularly, I come from a small town, Sparta. I've been a transplant to Sheboygan for years, but Sparta has a plant called Decamat that had dealings with Foxconn. And a retired executive from there, who was a very good friend, visited the plant at the time that Decamat was working with them and said he'd never seen such horrible pollution. It ran in the streets. I know that they have human rights problems. He said it would be a bad fit for Wisconsin.
Alice, thanks for the call. And Molly, also along with this budget, now the governor signed the Foxconn incentive package just a little earlier today.
Right.
So now negotiations start, right?
Right. So by the end of the month, the Governor Walker and the chairman of Foxconn have to sign the contract that kind of starts the whole process that we've been talking about for the last few weeks. Hopefully that will mean that, you know, they want the construction to start by next year on this facility. They still haven't picked a specific site for this, you know, $10 billion factory that they're proposing to build. But Governor Walker has said that he hopes that gets going by next year, the construction of that. The contract, it doesn't have legislative approval once it's signed. The bill was signed by Governor Walker with a couple vetoes in the language that the legislature included, but the contract that is ultimately signed will not come back to the legislature.
And getting back to the budget for a moment, the sticking point all along had been transportation.
Right.
How are we going to pay for road construction and repair? Do we raise gas taxes? What did we end up with after all these extra weeks of trying to hash
right.
that out?
Yeah, for weeks, the Republicans in the Assembly and the Senate were divided on borrowing, basically, and if the state can handle borrowing anymore, if there's not a new revenue stream and a way to pay down the debt that we already have for roads. The transportation fund has a nearly $1 billion shortfall right now. And what ended up happening is that there was $400 million in borrowing that was included in the budget. And they're going to impose a new fee on drivers of hybrid and electric vehicles. So starting next year, drivers of hybrid vehicles will be paying a $75 fee annually, and electric vehicle drivers will be paying a $100 annual fee. Starting January 1st.
And is this one that people came out of the legislature feeling happy about, the transportation deal such as it was?
I don't think the day that the Finance Committee voted on it, neither the Senate or the Assembly leaders that are leading that committee sounded very excited about what they were doing, but they, you know, we're happy that they finally agreed on something because it had been so long since they had been at the table. So I think everybody on both sides wants to find a more sustainable solution and didn't think this is it.
So that we'll probably be talking about this again in 2 years process starts again.
Right.
And then moving on to another issue that went back and forth, some K through 12 education. There had been some cuts in the past. Governor Walker adding funding to public education and charter schools and voucher schools in this budget. Mm-hmm. Where did we end up when it comes to education funding?
So the final number in new spending, everybody had been talking about $649 million. That's what the governor had initially proposed in new spending for schools, and the budget committee included $639 million dollars in new spending. And the voucher programs, they will see an increase, too, which is just how the law works, is if more money is sent to public schools, more money gets sent to the voucher schools. But they also expanded the statewide voucher program. They raised the income limits for that program. So wealthier families, not, I don't mean wealthy families, but wealthier families than who are eligible now will be able to get a voucher and attend a private, their students will be able to attend a private school using the voucher. The legislature also expanded the voucher program for students with disabilities as well.
And we talked earlier about those Republican holdouts. They wanted even more expansion of voucher mm-hmm. programs. Is that something the governor had committed to in his veto agreement with them?
He has not said that he will do that. I'm not sure if the way the veto process works, he can change a number that way. But we also haven't seen, like I said before, the complete veto message. So there might be something related to that there. What they want is 300% of the federal poverty level. That would be the income limit. And I believe for a family of four, that would be around $73,000 a year annual salary. And what they increased it to in this budget was 220%, which is around $54,000 a year for a family of four. So that they want to see that expansion. And it's unclear how many more vouchers that means, but that would be the income limits for it.
I want to bring on another caller. Paul is with us in Lincoln County. Paul, hi.
Good afternoon.
What do you want to tell us about, Paul?
Well, I am a county board supervisor here in Lincoln County, and tomorrow evening, out of something akin to desperation, we are going to be voting on a wheel tax thanks to the, I don't know what to call it, indecision or the decision of the legislature and the governor. I'm now in my third term on the county board, and every one of those years for us with our annual budget has been squeeze time, and the squeeze just gets worse and worse and worse. And we're at the point now where there are some people who are actually proposing virtually the elimination of our university extension departments. It's a catastrophe, and it just there seems to be no end in sight.
Paul, thanks for the call. Yeah, local governments are obviously very interested in what came out of the transportation budget. Mm-hmm. Is that an issue that came up much, how local governments were dealing with road funding?
Yeah, the budget does cut some funding for resurfacing, about $80 million, not a lot, but some. And I mean, that's always been a concern that people talk about when this whole debate has been going on for all summer and years, I guess you could say. Do local governments have enough money to fix up the roads in the way that they need to? And is the state providing the share that they feel they need?
We'll leave it there for now, Molly. It's all over, but the partial veto pen of the governor. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Molly Beck. She's a state capitol reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. She joined us today for an update on the full budget, 11 weeks overdue, but now it is passed in both houses of the state legislature, now on its way to the governor's desk.
Freshman State Representative Jimmy Anderson says he didn't want to become known as, quote, the wheelchair legislator. But as Laurel White reports, 8 months in office and a tumultuous national debate on health care reform changed his mind about putting his story front and center.
Representative Jimmy Anderson is visiting an elementary school in his district.
Good morning.
Yeah, we want to see some action here. What are you guys working on?
Anderson hears about this class's art project. Then he's serenaded by a music class. As a small crowd of adults listens, Anderson tells students their parents make the rules for them.
My job is to make rules for these guys.
But next
time you guys are in the Capitol, if you manage to find my office, I got a big jar of candy. Make sure to stop by and say hello.
During this visit, none of the kids ask why Anderson is in a wheelchair, and he's okay with that. When he was sworn in January, he says he didn't want to be known as the lawmaker in a wheelchair, the go-to guy for bills about disability rights.
There are people that are probably not disabled that know more about disability rights and disability issues than I do. And so to think that just because I sit in this chair, I know everything about the issues is sometimes can be a little offensive.
He says when he started this job, he wanted to talk about tax policy, environmental issues, or education.
I'm a legislator in a wheelchair. I'm not the wheelchair legislator.
But the crash that put Anderson in the wheelchair was undoubtedly horrible. Even though he doesn't want people to focus on his disability or the accident that caused it, he will talk about it. He told the story at a press conference in June.
It was coming up about 7 years ago, and a drunk driver murdered my mother and my father and my little brother, and I had to be trapped in that vehicle, and I had to beg my little brother to tell me that he was still alive, knowing that he was already gone.
After the accident, medical bills piled up. Anderson was nearing lifetime limits on his insurance. He says he thought his life was over. Then he was notified that part of the Affordable Care Act kicked in, and lifetime limits were gone. He told that part of his story during a speech on the assembly floor.
And it was the most freeing moment of my life. As I often tell people, it's what gave me hope. It's what gave me the opportunity to put my life back together, and it's the reason I'm here today.
This summer, as Congress mulled a possible repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act, Wisconsin Democrats held town halls about health care reform. Anderson shared his story. His staffer, Logan Vidal, says it touched a nerve. People who heard it wrote in. They wanted to hear more.
Like, we had so many of those stories where it was like, oh, we have to talk about this, not just from a we think this is going to, like, achieve our policy goals, but, like, our constituents are literally yelling at us, telling us to do this.
Anderson says that feedback opened his eyes, so he told his story more.
I do know that people in the community turn to me to be their voice because I live their life. I understand their experiences.
Anderson says he's no longer avoiding the wheelchair legislator identity.
And so it's important for me to be the best wheelchair legislator I can be.
And at the same time, he hopes people will realize that's not all he is. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.